Well, have a seat and turn with me to Daniel chapter 1. I'm going to be in the first six verses, at least to start. If you're new to C3, we're glad you're here this morning. We're in the middle of a series called The Big Story. We started in January of this year teaching, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and we're moving through the entire Bible and plan to end at the end of the year in Revelation. And while we're teaching that on Sunday mornings, as a church, hopefully many of us, hopefully all of us, are reading through the scriptures. If you haven't done that or you're not doing that, no reason not to start now. So there's no requirement that you start in Genesis. You can pick up with us where we are in the book of Ezekiel, finishing up Ezekiel, and we'll start into Daniel this week where we're going to be this morning. But we've watched as God's people have gone. Remember Adam and Eve created in the garden? We've watched them move from there, moved into Egypt where they were in slavery. God rescued them out of slavery. We saw the rise of Israel with the three kings, with Saul and David and Solomon. At the end of David's reign and into Solomon's reign, there was a time of peace. And now, as you've been reading over the last couple of months, we've been in a really desperate time in Israel and Judah. They went through a period of civil war. And then the northern kingdom was conquered by the Assyrian Empire. And then the southern kingdom, we know it as Judah most of the time as it's referred to in the scriptures, was conquered by the Babylonian Empire. And that's where we are in Daniel, as we pick up in Daniel chapter 1 and verse 1. It says, "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, the chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. And they were to be educated for 3 years. And at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. And among these were Daniel." And then three guys we know as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So as Seth opened this morning, and I have the privilege of filling in this morning. Michael's away with his family. He's actually teaching up north at his son's church, where his son is the worship leader. And Seth read this morning from 1 Peter chapter 2, which I want to use that text from 1 Peter chapter 2, particularly verses 11 and 12, and I'll read them again here in just a second. I want to use that as a paradigm through which we can view the book of Daniel, to draw from it some truths that I think should be true about us, because as we just read, Daniel is an exile. He's been hauled off into the Babylonian kingdom. And the way he lives is something that we can emulate. And as Seth read from 1 Peter chapter 2, if you've got a smartphone, you want to click over there and read it again with me. 1 Peter 2, 11 through 12, this great passage of who we are, that we are a holy people, a royal priesthood, that we would proclaim the excellencies of him who called us out of darkness. And one of the ways that we do that, verses 11 and 12, are two of the ways that we do that. He says, "Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles." We are all Daniels in a sense, sojourners and exiles, much as Daniel was, "to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation." These commands in 1 Peter 2 are for us. And when we look at Daniel, we see someone who lived as an exile excellently. He lived as a sojourner and an exile, and he did exactly what we are commanded to do in 1 Peter chapter 2. There's a twofold command here. The first part of the command is about our desires, and he says, you've got to abstain from sinful desires or sinful passions, which wage war against your soul. The second part of the command deals with our behavior. And interestingly, the behavior is not so much our behavior about keeping God's law, but rather living what he describes as an honorable life among the Gentiles. He deals with God's law first, keep your heart from or abstain from sinful passions. Then he deals with our conduct, and he measures that against how do we do, how will Gentiles or unbelievers look at our lives? Will they view that as honorable so that when they speak against us as evildoers, They will actually see our deeds or our works and glorify our Father in heaven. So what I want to do is take those two commands, the abstain from sinful passions and the keep our conduct honorable, and I want to lay those two against the book of Daniel, and we're going to go all through the book, and I'm going to try to show you how Daniel did that as an exile, and I'm going to do it in the form of, hopefully, application, so that all of us would look at Daniel and say, that should be true about me. Okay? So let's journey together through Daniel as we do that. In Daniel chapter 1, as I just read a minute ago, he is living in the ashes and the ruins of past generations' punishment. Obviously, as you go through the book of Daniel, he is a great man, a godly man, loves the Lord, does some incredible things. And it's a remarkable story. I mean, he's one of those guys who you'd love to have over for dinner, right? If Daniel lived in some other part of the country, if he lived in Seattle, Washington, and I sent you an email this week and said, Daniel's going to be at the house Saturday night, I'd love for you to come over for dinner, everybody would show up. Because the guy slept with lions, right? He did some pretty incredible things. So it's a remarkable story. So you'd love to hang out with him. But more remarkable than the stories are the life of Daniel and what he exalts and what he praises over the course of his life. So he stands as a model for us to how to live great as an exile. Point number one, taking right from 1 Peter, putting it into the lens of Daniel, and I'll show you this. Point number one is that we're to fight sinful desires. We're to fight sinful desires. Peter says it, that we're to abstain from the passions of the flesh. He uses war language, wage war against your soul. We're to fight sinful pleasures, desires, which wage war against our soul. There is a battle going on for our soul. It's a war for our soul. Peter also describes that there's a roaring lion walking around looking for someone to devour. Again, an analogy almost from Daniel, straight out of the pages of Daniel. He's looking for someone to devour. It's not generic. He's looking for someone to devour. There is a war going on that we are engaged in. It's just waging war against our soul, and we are to fight sinful desires in that battle. Here's how Daniel does it. I think he does it at least two ways, and we could look at a lot of ways he does it, but I think he does it at least two ways. The first way he does it there, A in your outline, is that he views God as the center of all things. And I want to show you that in Daniel's words, and then I'll show you in the structure of the book how he does it. But in Daniel's own words, he views God as the center of all things. It is the primary way in the book that Daniel battles against sinful desires and sinful pleasures. In chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has this dream. And he puts his wise men in the kingdom of Babylon to the test. Here's his plan. He has a dream, but he's not going to tell anybody the dream. He gathers up all the magicians, all the enchanters, all the wise men in Babylon, and he says, here's the deal. I want you to tell me the dream that I had. I'm not going to tell you what the dream is. I want you to tell me the dream and tell me what the dream means. And in the beginning of chapter 2, these wise men of Babylon, Daniel is one of them, so is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These wise men, a whole bunch of them, come to the king, and they keep pleading with him, like in verse 4, O king, live forever, tell your servants the dream, and we will show you the interpretations, even though the king said, I'm not going to tell you the dream. And then he goes on later, a little later in that chapter, and they say, this is impossible, no one could do this. No one could do that, king. No one could tell you the dream. Well, Daniel finds out about it, and at the end of Daniel chapter 2, in verse 20, God comes to Daniel in the middle of the night, and he tells Daniel the dream, and he tells him the interpretation of the dream. And after Daniel has the vision of the dream and the interpretation of the dream, Daniel wakes up, and in the middle of the night, go with me there, King Nebuchadnezzar is going to kill all of the wise men because they can't tell him the dream and the interpretation of the dream, so he thinks they're all frauds. So all the wise men in the kingdom are going to die. Daniel, one of those wise men, wakes up in the middle of the night. God's given him the vision. What's the first thing you say if you're going to die because you don't know the dream and the vision? You're going to go to, God, thank you for telling me the vision, right? Thank you for preserving my life. That's not where Daniel goes. Look at verse 20. Look how God-centered he is. Daniel answers, this is his prayer back to God, verse 20 of chapter 2. Blessed be the name of the God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might and have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's matters. Look at his praise of God. Look at what he says about him back in verse 20. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. Understanding, knowledge, that belongs to you, God, and might belongs to you. Then when he says, he changes the times and the season. God, you make the clock tick, or maybe in his day, the sundial move. You cause the earth to rotate around the sun. You cause it to get hot in the summertime, and then a little cooler in the fall as the leaves change. You cause it to be winter. You cause it to be spring and start to warm up again. And then it gets hot again. And that is because of you, God. This is not nature at work, God. This is you at work. Daniel understands that the clock ticks and the day turns because of the God of heaven. Then he goes to, he removes kings and sets up kings. This is going to be a theme in Daniel's life. He's not that intimidated by King Nebuchadnezzar, because he serves the God who sets kings up and takes kings out. That's Daniel's view. It's like, well, we got one king, now we got another king. God chose to raise up this king and then that king and this empire and that empire. No big deal. The God of heaven is in charge of the kings. He sets up kings. He takes kings down as he wills. He gives wisdom to the wise. So if anybody is wise, that wisdom came from him, because he gives all the wisdom to the wise. He gives knowledge to those who have understanding. Nobody has any knowledge apart from him. If anyone has understanding, it's because God gave it to him. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. Everything hidden, God knows. He knows all things. He is all powerful. He sees all things. Nothing is hidden from him. Daniel's view of God is that he knows all things, sees all things, works in all things. Now, you're in the middle of the night. Nebuchadnezzar is going to kill all the wise men. God gives you the vision. You know what the dream is. What do you say when you walk into Nebuchadnezzar? And what is going on inside the heart in those intervening hours? I'll tell you what's going on in my heart. My heart is going on like, I'm better than all the other wise men in Babylon, right? I mean, that's the sinful desire. The sinful desire is selfishness of, I'm better than everybody else. Look at verse 27. Daniel shows up to the king. He says, no wise men, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show to the king the mystery that the king has asked. Verse 28, but. Now, what do you say after you say but to the king when you told him no wise men, no enchanters, no magicians, no astrologers? I say, but I, right? But I can, not Daniel. Daniel says, but there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen, what will be in the latter days. You see that Daniel cuts himself out? Not only does he not say, but Daniel or but I, he just skips himself completely and says, but God knows mysteries and he made it known to Nebuchadnezzar. It's like Daniel disappeared in the whole picture. That is the way Daniel views all things. God is the center of all things. It's about him, not about me. Chapter 5, turn over to chapter 5. There's another king now. It's Nebuchadnezzar's son. We're going to go back and forth through Daniel. I hope that's okay with you. Daniel chapter 5 and verse 17. This time, there's been a crazy story where there's handwriting on the walls because his son, Belshazzar's wicked guy, he's taken all the vessels out of the temple and turned them into a big party and orgy there in his palace. And this hand writes three words on the wall, and no one knows what the words mean except Daniel. And the king has offered him all these gifts and rewards for telling him what these mean, and Daniel's going to tell him. In verse 17, Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be for yourself, and give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. Now listen. Listen to what he says. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. When he's called before the king, he interprets what it means. And then he sets right the God who sets up kings and removes kings. I'm here to tell you, king, I just want you to know that your father and now you get to be king because the God of heaven put you there. This is the perspective of David in paragraph after paragraph throughout the whole book, where he sees God as the hope and the promise of the world. And it doesn't matter what's going on in his circumstances. Daniel keeps going back to the reality that there is a God in the heavens who sets up kings and removes kings. So let the lions come, let the fiery furnace come, let the king come and want to kill us. I don't care. I'm serving the God of heaven. Now, I don't have time to do this, and I'm not going to do it, but in chapters 8 through 12, you have all of these visions, which are basically general outlines of world history. And at the end of most of these general outlines of history, you have this kingdom that is set up, and it's a description of what heaven is going to ultimately be, that we serve and live, will live in an eternal kingdom under the reign of Christ, the rule and reign of Christ that will never be destroyed. That unlike all the other kings and kingdoms throughout all of world history, which a king rises and then he falls, and a kingdom rises and then it falls, we are a part of a kingdom that will rise and never fall again. Amen. And his perspective, his big picture perspective, his big story perspective of my God will reign and rule forever, and his kingdom will not be destroyed. It governs everything that Daniel does and everything that he says. It is his big picture view of I'm going to battle sinful desires because my God is going to win, and that kingdom that I'm a part of is going to be an everlasting kingdom. And it's one of the ways that we battle sinful desires, that we trade away small temporary pleasures for what brings honor and glory to a king who will reign forever and ever, whose kingdom will not be destroyed. We see it not only in his words, we see it also in the structure of the book. And I know a lot of you probably don't love literature, so I won't spend a whole lot of time on this point, but I do want you to see it because it's important to the way Daniel writes, and I think it moves right into this point of seeing God as central of all things. The first six chapters of Daniel are biographical, largely. They're a biographical sketch. They don't tell you every story of his life, and they don't close all of the gaps of what happened when he was a kid and what happened in certain periods of time, but it's basically a biographical sketch of his life with a few really incredible stories. In chapters 8 through 12, he has these visions. If you look at it, chapters 1 and chapters 8 through 12 are actually written in Hebrew. Chapters 2 through chapter 7 are written in Aramaic, the language of the people in which he's living among. So they don't divide perfectly. It's not as though the historical stuff is in Aramaic and the future stuff is in Hebrew. It's sort of mixed. And so as you start to try to figure out, like, where's the outline here? Where's the clear divisions? It's not real clear. And Daniel, in those visions, in the end, those visions, as you look at the timing of when they came to Daniel, they actually happened during the first six chapters at different points in time. And so as a Westerner, you look at it and you're like, where's the linear progression here? I want a timeline and I want to move down the timeline so I understand that's not the way Daniel's written. Daniel is written like a spiral staircase. And the spiral in the center of that staircase is the greatness of God. And what Daniel wants you to do as you turn the pages and read the sentences and take the steps of lion's den and fiery furnace and talking to the king and interpreting dreams and having visions and seeing about what the world is, every step is a reminder to the reader, to us, that our God is great. And it spirals around that point all the way to Daniel chapter 12, where we get to the end of time and all of mankind stands before the judge and receives one of two outcomes. Either we spend eternity in what Daniel calls everlasting life, that is heaven, or alternatively, it's shame and eternal or everlasting contempt. He views God as the God over all things, and every step is a progression in that to the ultimate end of his eternal kingdom, which we would call heaven. Spiraling around that staircase so that we would say, in all things, God is great. And you see it throughout the book in every story. Whatever Daniel does, he's pointing back to the greatness of God. He's saying, see the greatness of God, see the greatness of God. So that when we read the book of Daniel, the aim at the end of the book of Daniel is not for us to say Daniel was a great guy. Wow, what a hero of the faith Daniel was. Although Hebrews would describe him as a man of whom the world was not worthy, the aim is to make God look good. And Daniel does that step by step. As you tread the steps, you're pointed back to the greatness of our God. His writing reflects what Daniel's life reflects, that he is the God who governs all things, orders all things, sustains all things, gives life, and gives meaning to all things. And so if I'm battling sinful desires, which I am, and sinful passions, where do I turn my eyes? I turn them towards Him, and I view Him as the center of all things, who governs and reigns and gives meaning to all things. The second thing you see from Daniel B there is that we are to pray thoughtfully. Pray thoughtfully. I struggled with the right adverb there. I want to say it like Paul says it and say, pray always. Or maybe for you, better is pray humbly. You could see all of those things in Daniel. We don't see enough of Daniel's life to see that he prays always. I'll show you that he prays three times a day. I think Paul meant more than that. I think when he said pray without ceasing, he literally means pray all the time. So I went with pray thoughtfully, and maybe you put a different adverb there for yourself. I thought about just saying pray, but I don't. Can you just have a point that's just pray? I mean, if you could, maybe that's what you should write down and just say pray, because we can learn that from Daniel. Daniel chapter 6, and this is the cool story. I mean, this is the big story that everybody knows out of the book of Daniel. Daniel in the lion's den, he's going to get thrown into the lion's den, and his buddies, those other wise men, they go to the king, King Darius. We're now in a new kingdom, by the way. Babylon's passed away. Now it's the Medes and the Persians. We've got a new king. King Darius is there. And he's got this structure set up, 120 satraps and these three presidents. Daniel's the head over the presidents. He's the top dude just below King Darius. And they go to King Darius and they trick King Darius into setting up this law that no one can pray to anyone but him. That's a problem for Daniel because Daniel prays three times a day. And the law says that if you pray to anyone other than King Darius, you get thrown into the lion's den. That was their means by which they executed people. If you look at the end of chapter 6, when they get Daniel out and he's not been eaten by the lions, King Darius goes and gathers up all these other people who tricked him. He gets them, their children, and he throws them into the lion's den. The text says that they were torn from limb to limb in pieces before they ever hit the floor. Okay, so this is a horrific form of capital punishment. And what strikes me about this is the law says you pray, you get eaten by lions. You pray, you get eaten by lions. And I was going down the list this week of the things that keep me from praying, and lions didn't make the list. And I'm blown away by the fact that lions didn't make the list, because then I think, well, maybe I would fight sinful passions in my life better if you got all the way down the list of all the things that keep me from praying, and I got rid of those. Lions was on the list, and I could get over that one. Daniel was a man of prayer, and he has no promise. Verse 10, look at verse 10 here for just a second. Verse 10, knew that the document had been signed, this law. He went into his house where he had windows in his upper chamber, open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees three times a day, prayed, and gave thanks before his God. Here's the phrase at the end of verse 10. As he had done previously. Nothing changed. New law, can't pray, you're going to get eaten by lions. Daniel just does the same thing he's been doing for a long time. Three times a day, window open, I don't care who sees me. Lions aren't going to stop me from praying. You understand that Daniel has no promise that the lions aren't going to eat him? You ever thought about that? You ever thought about the fact that there's no promise in Daniel's life that the lions aren't going to eat him? As a matter of fact, his contemporaries, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, it didn't go so well for them. Isaiah, sawn in half. Jeremiah, thrown in a pit, a horrific pit, for a long time. Ezekiel, we read that this week. Remember what happens with Ezekiel? God comes to him and says, as a sign to the nation of Israel, I'm going to take away the delight of your eyes, your wife. She's going to die tonight. And then I don't want you to mourn. So if he's looking around and he's going to quote, I'll show you in a minute, he's going to quote these prophets. So he knows their story, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. He knows about them. So if you're Daniel and you go, the law is signed, you know about the document, you go to pray, Daniel is not thinking, God's going to do a miracle and save me from the lions. Daniel's thinking, probably going to happen to me what happened to Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. This is not going to go well. He has no promise. So he's not looking to be the star of a really cool story. He's thinking, I'd rather pray. I'd rather pray. And if praying means I get eaten by lions, then I'm praying. That's Daniel. No promise or protection. He's fighting sinful desires to preserve his own life. Man, now we're getting serious. How much sinful desire and selfishness is in us when it gets all the way down to, I want to preserve my life? And in the midst of fighting that passion, Daniel fights it by praying. Daniel chapter 9. Let me show you one of his prayers. Daniel chapter 9, he's praying for his people, and this is a model prayer for us. Hopefully helpful for us. It's why I said pray thoughtfully. This is not just a casual prayer. It's not just a flippant prayer. It's not, God, make my day good and give me something to eat. It's a thoughtful prayer. I think he was three times a day on his knees before God thoughtfully. So I'm not going to read all of these verses, but the prayer is in verses 4 through 19, 15 verses. And there are some elements of this prayer I want to highlight for you. It is full of Bible. So he quotes in those 15 verses, at least these verses. Exodus 32:11, Numbers 6:25, Deuteronomy 7:9, Psalms 25:11, Psalm 31:1, Psalm 40 verse 7, Psalm 71 verse 2, Psalm 86:15, Isaiah 1:4, Isaiah 37:7, Jeremiah 1:12. In 15 verses of prayer. When this guy opens his mouth before his God, Bible comes out. Bible comes out. I love that. You see in verse 2 of the chapter 9, that he has perceived in the writings from Jeremiah 29, that he's going to be in captivity for 70 years. You're a young man, you're hauled off into captivity. You have no hope of getting out. You're going to be there 70 years, God said. The Bible is a prayer guide for us, and one of the things that Eat This Book should do for us is it should help our prayer life. Because it tells us what is true about us and what is true about him. And so when I pray and Bible comes out about God, I'm saying things that are true about him. And when Bible comes out, I'm saying things that are true about me, both in my sinful state and what God has done in me to begin to conform me into the image of his son and what is ultimately true about me at the end of my life. So Bible comes out of Daniel. There's also humble confession. Daniel doesn't use words like misstep and weakness and fault and shortcomings and, oh, I made a mistake. There's no excuses in this. There's no defenses. There's no explanations. It's just raw, raw confessions. 14 times he uses words to describe what he and his people have to confess, and none of them are soft. Look at verse 5 as an example of this. We have sinned, done wrong, acted wickedly, rebelled, turning aside from your commandments and rules. What a great picture of what confession should look like. God, I didn't make a mistake. I sinned. I rebelled. I turned away. I did what was wrong. This is heartfelt, deep heart work that he's done in his own heart, and he identifies in that of the people, and he's honest about it, blunt about it. Then there's worship throughout this. It goes back and forth. This prayer goes back and forth between confession and worship, confession and worship. God, you're great. We're sinful. God, you're great. You're full of mercy and compassion. God, we're sinful. Your steadfast love. I'm sinful. I'm rebellious. It goes back and forth between those two things. Verse 4, he starts the prayer, O Lord, the great God, an awesome God who keeps his covenant, steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments. That doesn't sound so good when you get into the confession part. But then in verse 9, he says, to the Lord, our God, belong mercy and forgiveness. For we have rebelled against him. Daniel has this great view. He doesn't dwell in self-pity. He doesn't avoid the fact that he feels guilty because he is guilty. He doesn't avoid the guilt. He goes straight into the guilt and says, this is true about me. I'm a rebel. But it is also true about me that my God is full of mercy and forgiveness. He doesn't dwell in self-pity. He lifts his eyes back to the central theme that God is over all and in all things. His eyes go back to the glory and beauty and majesty, the steadfast love of the Lord, and he embraces that forgiveness. Last thing I'd say about this prayer that I think is true in Daniel's life that we can emulate is that he bases his appeal on God for God's sake, verse 19. This whole central view of God, he views God as central to all things. In verse 19, he ends his prayer, O Lord, hear, O Lord, forgive. O Lord, pay attention and act. Do not delay for your own sake, O my God. because your city and your people are called by your name. We end our prayers by saying, in Jesus' name, amen. And we say that in part because we should be recognizing that we have a mediator before our Father. The only reason why we can go to God is because of Christ, his work at the cross, his redeeming of us. Therefore, we have a mediator, a go-between, someone who can go on our behalf before the Father and make our request known. We say in Jesus' name because he's our mediator. But what should also be true is that while we say in Jesus' name, we should be thinking, God, do what I'm asking for your name's sake, not for my name's sake. It's not about me, it's about you. And Daniel gets that, this God's central view of all things. It's how we fight, at least through the framework of Daniel, how we can fight sinful passions. View God as central to all things. Pray thoughtfully, pray humbly, pray always, pray. We do that. Second thing, keep your conduct honorable. Keep your conduct honorable. Point number two, keep your conduct honorable. Daniel did a number of things to live an honorable and a respectful life. You think about the passage, 1 Peter 2. When I think about the word honorable, it's interesting, Daniel, again, Peter doesn't say live a holy life, live a righteous life. He says live an honorable life, as measured by the Gentiles, so that when Gentiles see you, they see your deeds and they glorify your Father. This is about how you live in culture relative to what culture is demanding of you. How do you live honorably among a people who don't think anything like you? How do you live as an exile honorably? The main way I see in the life of Daniel is that he lives at peace with people. And I want to show you that. Romans 12:18 says, if possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Live peaceably with all. Let me show you how Daniel does this. Go back to chapter 1. Look at the first six verses. 2 weeks ago, verse 1, 2 weeks ago, Joe talked about what it meant that King Nebuchadnezzar besieged the city of Jerusalem. If you were like me and I was sitting like right over here somewhere, my stomach was churning when he was describing what it was like as people ate their own children. Horrific. Okay, that king who did that, that's the guy who Daniel's going to serve. Okay? Besieges the city. That's a bad deal. Verse 2, he took out Daniel's king, Jehoiakim. Wiped that guy out. With some of the vessels of the house of God, things that Daniel treasured in worship, Nebuchadnezzar came in and took those things and used them for his own use. Then look what happens. Verse 3, the king commanded this Ashpenaz guy, this chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel. Verse 4, use without blemish. Bring them in, teach them understanding and learning, make them competent to stand in the king's palace. At the end of verse 4, to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. They want to brainwash Daniel. They want to make him think as a Babylonian thinks. And what are we talking about? Like, you're going to spend a semester doing that? We're going to spend like a couple of weeks doing that? You got like an executive summary of what I got to think about if I'm a Babylonian? No. Verse 5. They were to be educated for 3 years. 3 years. He got kidnapped to be brainwashed for 3 years. Among them were Daniel. Look at what happens down in, one more thing, verse 7. The chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel, he called Belteshazzar. You know what Daniel means? Daniel means God is my judge. Belteshazzar was an allusion to one of their God's names. So in addition to taking him out of his city, kidnapping, wiping out his own king, besieging the people, hauling him off to be brainwashed for 3 years, I hate your name. I'm going to give you a new name. I'm going to call you by the name of my God, not your God. How's that? You got a pile of offenses, a whole bunch of stuff you did to me. Now look down here at the end of chapter 1. We'll start verse 8. I'll show you this one first. Verse 8, Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. He didn't go in and say, I'm not eating your food. I'm not defiling myself. He asked him, can I please not do that? Can I not eat your food and drink your wine? Look how wise this is. Verse 12. Listen to the softness of his language. The chief of the eunuch's response to Daniel was like, no, you're going to eat the king's food, not for your sake, but because if you don't eat it, I'm going to lose my head. So what does Daniel say? Daniel says, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you and deal with your servants according to what you see. Daniel says, if you really, well, just watch, okay? Just watch for 10 days. Can you give me 10 days to do this? You give me 10 days, watch what I eat, watch what they eat, and then judge us. And then at the end of 10 days, you judge. That is incredibly respectful, given what he's been through. Look at the end of the chapter, verse 19. This is at the end of 3 years. So Daniel's been in the midst of it for 3 years, being schooled and learned in all the ways of the Babylonians. And the king spoke with them, and among all of them there was none found like Daniel, and then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That's their names they were given. Therefore they stood before the king, and in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better. Now, can you just picture in your mind the body language you would have if a king had done what they had done to Daniel when you got to the end of 3 years and you got a chance to address the king? For 3 years, he applied himself diligently to learn what they asked him to learn the language, to learn all the literature. And when he shows up, he's worked hard, 10 times harder than anybody else around him, and he's got the answers to the questions that the king asked, and the king is blown away. No compromise in Daniel. He didn't change the way he think. When he was exposed to the world religions, he didn't change the way he think. That's clear in the book. But what was also clear was that he was as much as possible aiming to live at peace with all men. You want me to learn your language? I'll learn your language. You want me to read that book? I'll read that book. I'm not compromising, but I'll read your book. He found them to be incredibly wise. Here's another one. Chapter 2. Chapter 2, this dream comes to Nebuchadnezzar. We talked about it. He doesn't tell them the dream. This is back to, he doesn't tell them the dream. They have to tell him the dream and tell him the answer. Look in verse 14. In verse 14, the guy comes to kill him because he's one of the wise guys and wise men of Babylon. He comes to kill him. Listen to how Daniel responds to this Arioch, the captain of the king's guard. He declared to him, why is the decree of the king so urgent? Not, this isn't fair. He hasn't asked me. Why don't I get another chance? None of that. Why is the decree of the king so urgent? Such wisdom. You see this over and over again in Daniel's life. Now go down to verse 37. Verse 37. He starts, he's told the king the dream. The king's probably blown away. Daniel's told him what he said, what he saw in his dream. In verse 37, he starts the interpretation of that dream to the king. You, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the might, the glory. Listen to how he addresses him. You, O king, the king of kings. How respectful that is. How peaceful that is. He speaks to Nebuchadnezzar, this wicked guy, as the king of kings, the one who had conquered all of these empires. Look down in verse 49. Man of peace, Daniel. At the end of it, the king's blown away. He knows the dream. He knows the interpretation. He puts Daniel, he promotes Daniel, gives all this stuff to Daniel. What does Daniel do? First request he makes of the king is, can you appoint Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon? Not about him. It's about making peace. And he makes it with his friends, and he makes it with his enemies. Let me show you another one, chapter 4. I'll wrap up here. Chapter 4. Chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar has a second dream. Nebuchadnezzar, unless you stop sinning, and start showing mercy to the oppressed, God's going to make you like a beast of the field. You're going to go out and eat grass and drink the dew off of the grass. Watch the language to the king when Daniel goes to tell him the interpretation and the meaning of the second dream that Nebuchadnezzar has. In verse 19, he says, he's alarmed by the meaning of the dream. At the end of verse 19, he says, my Lord, Belteshazzar is Daniel's new name. My Lord, may the dream be for those who hate you and its interpretation for your enemies. Look down in verse 27. Start practicing righteousness in your iniquities by showing mercy to the oppressed, that there may be perhaps a lengthening of your prosperity. This is the guy, King Nebuchadnezzar. And Daniel says, let your life prosper for a longer period of time. We're struggling with, don't tell him what it means. Maybe it'll kill him, right? And Daniel says, hey, here's what I want for you, King. I want a lengthening of your prosperity. Turn from your sin. Man of peace. Nebuchadnezzar, we read this dream in chapter 5. Belteshazzar, he pronounces the judgment on this king with such grace that the king gives him the purple robe and gives him a reward. In chapter 6, there's a new king and a new kingdom. Daniel does it again with a new king and a new kingdom. In verses 4 and 5, the people are trying to find a complaint against Daniel for some reason to get him killed. And they say, we can't find any ground for any grounds to accuse him of anything. He's done nothing wrong. And then in verse 5, they say, we will never find one. Daniel lives so honorably among his people. Not only did they not have anything on him, they knew as long as they looked, they would not find anything wrong with him. Verse 21 of chapter 5. We'll end here. In verse 21, it says that, and this is the king, Nebuchadnezzar, he's driven, he's a wild beast, he was fed grass like an ox, until he knew the Most High God rules over the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. That's the response, that's the why it happens to him. So that until the king gets to the place where he sees God over all things, he's going to eat grass like an ox eats grass. In every one of these instances, three kings, two different kingdoms, in every one of the instances, you'll read them this week, and I want you to look for them. In every instance, you know what Daniel says when he's given this opportunity? He tells them about the greatness of God every time. O King, the God of the heavens. O King, the great God. O King, and he tells them about the greatness of his God. It's where Daniel constantly goes. In two instances in the book, the king says back to Daniel, basically, you are a son of the Most High God. This is the words of Jesus. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. What's cool in the book of Daniel is you see not only what you would say is true about Jesus, that we are going to be called sons of God by God, but the sons of men, unbelievers, people who have no interest in God, view the peacemaker Daniel, and they call him a son of God. And I want to encourage us this morning in a culture that is so opposed to us, in political issues over the last couple of months in Houston that we are adamantly opposed to in terms of our belief. Are we peaceful people in response to that? Are we living honorable, respectful lives so that Gentiles would look at us, unbelievers look at us, and find no opportunity for pointing out our error? Are we living like that? Because if we live like that, we give opportunity for people to look at our deeds and glorify our Father. And that should be our aim. We live holy lives, fighting sinful passions, and at the same time live among culture and try to live peaceably with all men so that we have the opportunity to tell about the greatness of our God.